Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming for these sessions on social determinants of health from global to national levels. And it's a great opportunity that have honorable speakers to share experience on this movement. May I introduce Professor Sir Michael Mommott, the Director of International Institute for Society and Health and MRC Research Professor of Epidemiology and Public Health at University College London. And he was the Chair of Commission on Social Determinants of Health set up by the World Health Organization. Secondly, Dr. Narongsak Ankaswapala, he is currently the Senior Advisor of Thailand's National Health Commission Office and also selected as the chair of the Thai Social Determinants of Health. Right. And thirdly, Honorable Mary Collins, she is the director of the Secretariat for the British Columbia Healthy Living Alliance. He has a long experience on so many sectors, from working at a government sector, NGOs, and civil society as well. And the last one, Ms. Bridget Loy, she is Global Coordinator of People Health Movement, which is the civil society movement, has 21 networks around the globe, right. Firstly, I would like to give a presentation on Thailand movement 30 years long on this movement, and Khun Warisa will give a presentation shortly to save our time, give an overview of what's going on in this country.
Social determinants of health movement through the journey of health system reform in Thailand. The concept of social determinants of health has been applied in health. The concept of social determinants of health has been applied in the health system of Thailand since the Alma-Atak Declaration in 1978. Thailand has worked purposefully to develop primary health care. Thailand shifts its health development strategy to emphasize health promotion in accordance with the Ottawa Charter in 1986. The Health System Research Institute was set up in 1992 to generate new sets of knowledge to support health promotion strategy. The perspective on health has been beyond public health since then. The 1997 Constitution of Kingdom of Thailand was enacted to place importance on participatory democracy. 2 years later, the Decentralization Act of 1999 was enacted to allocate taxes and duties, especially public services delivery from the central government to the local governments. The Constitution has reaffirmed many rights of the people, one of which is the right to health. In 2000, the Senate Committee on Public Health publicized the National Health System Report, simulating a need to reform the totality of the health system to follow the idea of build health before repair. The health system reform was started in 2000 to keep pace with the changing society and globalization. Health cannot rely on single authorities unit anymore. Many health-related organizations have emerged to achieve all for health. In 2001, Health Promotion Foundation was created under the Health Promotion Foundation Act to turn health promotion opportunities into concrete action by the public sector. This is funded by sin taxes collected from producers and importers of alcohol and tobacco. In 2002, the National Health Security Act was enacted to provide health financing reform on universal coverage, with a single standard and a sustainable system. The National Health Security Office was established accordingly. In 2005, Thailand was honored to host the 6th Global Conference for Health Promotion. The Bangkok Charter agreed among the participants at the conference, encouraged the government to launch Healthy Thailand Strategy. The window of political opportunity on health was then opened. Thailand finally had a National Health Act in 2007. It has shifted the paradigm of health because it redefined health by covering physical, mental, social, and spiritual dimensions. The Act creates a mechanism and tools for developing health equity in all policies, simply called healthy public policies. From the Health Act, two important issues were the National Health Commission and people's right to acquire health information explanation from state agency prior to a permission or performance of program which may affect their health and have their right to express their opinion on such matter. National Health Commission is chaired by the Prime Minister and plays a role to advocate healthy public policy to the government. It is a cross-sectoral mechanism comprising government sector, academic, and civil society from health and non-health sectors. National Health Assembly is a neutral forum that allows stakeholders to collectively develop, implement, and monitor healthy public policies. Resolutions from the Assembly can be channeled to the Cabinet via the National Health Commission. National Health Assembly is a social innovation to create healthy public policies, and the theory behind this movement is the triangle that moves the mountain strategy. This strategy explains that cracking the difficult problem, symbolized as mountain, requires concerted movements in the three areas: enhancement power of knowledge, social mobilization, and political involvement. From health for all to all for health, Thailand has driven the social determinants of health movement by embracing various sectors to take health or health equity into policies and programs. The examples of cross-sector collaboration implemented to solve health problems are compulsory licensing, which comply with the international regulation and is a case that the Ministry of Health worked closely with Ministry of Commerce and Ministry of Foreign Affairs to increase access to essential medicines that benefits health security in our society. Tobacco control movement and control of alcohol-related problems are other good examples that receive intersectoral collaboration in putting the campaigns into action. The lesson learned from this movement is we cannot focus only on health, but also other social determinants of health. The Thai Social Determinants of Health Network was formed after three important global social determinants of health movements. The first one was at the Commission on Social Determinants of Health meeting, which Thai representatives participated and shared their opinions and ideas. Then the Colombo Call for Action was the Regional Consultation on Social Determinants of Health, addressing health inequities through action on social determinants of health in Colombo, Sri Lanka on February 2009. And the third one was the 62nd World Health Assembly 2009. The network aims to synergize health and non-health sectors, which have already worked on equity to have value added to their work, do monitoring and evaluation of health equity and social determinants of health in order to advocate the society what policies or programs are needed. Building on our past efforts, we will work to ensure collaboration and secure future health equity, especially on the disadvantaged people. With this network, we believe that the gap can be closed in our generation. Thank you.
Right. I think it's quite difficult to brief health movement in Thailand in 10 minutes, but maybe Dr. Narongsa can add something on this movement.
Thank you very much. Would you please go to the slide number 2? Yes, I would like to just in conclusion to show that they mentioned for the previous decade, since we accept the primary health care as our principal strategy for our health care or our health service system reform for being recognized as a first wave. In the first wave, the big change is to narrowing the gap of the health service accessibility of the people, especially in the rural area. We're using the primary health care concept, say that we lead orientation. We orientate our national health budgeting of resource to construct infrastructure in the rural or in the peripheral area. So from that movement or from that reform, the coverage or the accessibility of health service of Thai people increasing a lot, and it narrowing the gap of inequity between the rural and the urban people. Each province, we will have a provincial hospital. We have at the district level, we at least one district hospital, one district. And at the sub-district, at least one health center. In some sub-district, they have 4 to 5 health center. And these are the institution-based service. For the community-based, we have the volunteer. We have a voluntary health volunteer. And at this moment, we have more than 1 million village health volunteer to link between the institution-based care and the community-based care. And at that time, the health service in the institution service mostly a public unit or public organization, they will provide, we call it integrated health service. That means every service level, they provide health promotion, prevention, curative, and rehabilitation. And we have a specific work, so that the work list for them, that how much you can do according to the resource person in each level and in each category. So this link by the referral system and supervision. And not just only provincial, we have a group of province. We identify one major province to be the regional level, and each regional, they can have the referral system and supervision among them. So these are the backbone of our health service system, and this is our national asset until this moment. The second wave of reform, we focus on the system management and the public policy. So for this movement, say that we can say that it start after the constitution of 1997, or we call it the people constitution. And from that, we have the health financial reform through the National Health Security Act. We have the increasing the mechanism. We have the support, the mechanism of the triangle that mentioned that moving the mountain, government, community, and technical. The this kind of react or this kind of action, we support through the health, the Thai Health Promotion Foundation, which they have a lot of money that the government support them through the syntax, earmark the syntax to support this foundation. And this foundation act as a catalytic organization for the community, for the government organization, or even for the technical organization to work together to level up. It's the kind of research and level development, but mainly focus on the health promotion and prevention model, that how to work together. So these are the mechanism that we have in our system. And we also have the National Health Act, which start from the Senate Committee that they have realized that although we have done a lot of things, but it's just located at the midstream or the lowstream or the downstream. We can cure a lot, we can care a lot of disease, but we cannot cure the problem. And they have realized that the very strong successive factor is how to lead. That means how to lead the right direction. So the public policy is the commitment that if we can have a strong and efficient public policy, this will be the answer how to lead the health system in our country to bettering health situation in Thailand. Movement start to, we have a 7-year drafting the National Health Act, and from that 7-year experience, we gain a lot, especially the realization of the society that they have a power, and if they can collect together not only the political power, also the technical power and wisdom power. National Health Assembly that you attend at this moment is the product from that 7-year experience. And we have the National Health Act and the National Health Commission, which chaired by the Prime Minister. And this will be our national health public policy, the public policy formulation body, which listen to the voice of the people, because the mechanism that they're forming the policy, it start from the grassroots. Say that each province they have a provincial council, and then regional council, and then national council, and then make the final draft to propose to the National Health Commission, and after that go to the government. So these are the very democratic means to propose the public policy. So these are our national asset at this moment. So I would like to add something like this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Narongsak. Before we go to discussion, can we move to Sir Michael Marmor to draw your experience on globally and nationally? Before that, probably we have heard him a lot about the global movement, but he also working for the government of England as well. Please, for your presentation.
Well, thank you. Just what I just heard now from Thailand confirms my view that this is a special place and special things are happening here. And it sums up, in a way, the spirit of the Commission on Social Determinants of Health, which was of mutual learning of what the Commission's various mechanisms of learning from what was happening in different countries and then sharing what we got and putting it back into countries. So I think, and as I said yesterday, the reason I'm here is how much we all have to learn from what's been happening in Thailand. So I want to thank you for that. And it relates to one of the concerns that I had during the course of doing the commission, which was, would anybody take it seriously when we finished? And clearly you are taking it seriously in Thailand. Next slide, please. And I'm pleased to say that we are taking it seriously in the UK. We had some colleagues from Thailand attended this seminar in London in November 2008, and it was opened by the Prime Minister. We call the seminar Closing the Gap in a Generation. You recognize the style from the Thai version of the publication. And it was opened by the Prime Minister, who said, what is written there? So he announced that I was going to do this review, which we started in January. We will finish on the 23rd of December, which is quite soon. If I look a bit distracted, it's because I'm in my head editing the final version of the review, and we'll publish it on the 11th of February. Next. This is why we're doing it. Female life expectancy, non-manual and manual, from the early 70s to the mid-2000s. You can see that life expectancy has been getting better for everybody, very welcome. The manual has been rising. But the gap between the manual and non-manual, if anything, has increased. So it's very welcome that everybody's health is getting better. But we would like to narrow the gap. Next. And that's male. And you see the same phenomenon. Getting better for everybody, but the gap has not narrowed. If anything, it's got wider. Next. I apologize for this, but this is becoming the signature tune of the review. The top graph is life expectancy, and each one of those dots represents a small area in the country. And these areas are ranked according to income deprivation. So they're small areas. And you can see the gradient. If we looked at the fifth centile, that's high deprivation, and the 95th centile, which is high affluence, the gap in life expectancy is 7 years. Now look at the bottom one, which is disability-free life expectancy. You can see that the gradient is steeper. And I emphasize the gradient. It's not just that the poor have bad health, but it's a graded phenomenon. And you can see this gradient, this continuous relation between deprivation and health, which is very important because it means if we focused only on the very poorest, only on poverty, we'd miss most of the problem. Now that's very challenging because what it means, and certainly in Britain, I don't know about Thailand, but in Britain, social policy has always tended towards focusing on the deprived. It's the Anglo-Saxon model, I think. You focus on the deprived. And people say, why would you want to spend money where the problem is not the greatest? And the answer is because we are all at risk. All of us who are below the average are at risk, the gradient. So if you look at the disability-free life expectancy and compare the fifth with the 95th centile, there's now a 17-year gap, whereas for life expectancy it was a 7. Now I not doing a very good job, which is what's the economic case? And people ask, what's the cost of the different interventions that you're proposing and the cost of doing nothing? Well, we will come up with some figures on the cost of doing nothing. They're totally arbitrary, imaginary numbers, but we will come up with some numbers because people are asking us to come up with numbers. But to my mind, a more powerful case is that green line. That green line there, drawn at 68. National policy is to move pension age, the age of retirement, to 68 by 2024. If in 2024 the situation that obtains today obtained, then 90% of the population do not have disability-free life expectancy as long as 68 years. If everybody with disability were on disability benefit, the effect of prolonging working age to 68 would be to move people off pensions onto disability benefit. So my argument is, you want an economic argument, you've got to have joined up government, because if one part of government is moving towards having a pension age at 68 and you're not dealing with the social gradient and disability free life expectancy, then you're on a collision course. You cannot, is my argument, avoid this. Next slide, please. So I said 7 years on average. This is Greater London, I live in Camden, which is between those two red arrows. Yeah, that's Camden. I live in the northern bit of Camden. I could cycle from my home to Tottenham Green in Haringey, and life expectancy for men, I could cycle there in about half an hour, and life expectancy for men is 71. And assuming I got back safely, I could cycle from Camden to Queen's Gate Ward in Kensington and Chelsea in about half an hour, and life expectancy is 88. So it's about 60 minutes of cycling, quite apart from what cycling on London's roads would do to my life expectancy, let alone Bangkok's roads. 60 minutes of cycling would have enhanced my life, and there's a gap of 17 years in one of the richest cities in the world. So we've talked a lot about the global issue of inequities in health, and we've got 17-year gap in a 60-minute cycle ride in London. Next, please. As I say, we're going to publish the review on the 11th of February, but let me give you the framework. So our overall is to reduce health inequalities. We call it inequalities rather than inequities, just by usage, and improve health and well-being for all. We've got two overall policy goals: to create an enabling society that maximizes individual and community potentials and ensure social justice, health, and sustainability. And we've put the climate change sustainability argument very strongly at the heart of all policies. And then we've got six policy objectives. So our recommendations will be in these six areas: give every child the best start in life, enable all children, young people and adults to maximize their capabilities to control their lives. So that's to do with education and lifelong learning. Create fair employment and decent work for all. Ensure healthy standard of living for all. Create and develop healthy and environmentally sustainable places and communities. Strengthen the role and impact of ill health prevention. You notice that we've said very little about the healthcare system. Now, in fact, in these two policy mechanisms, equality and health equity in all policies and effective evidence-based delivery systems, in the second one, the healthcare system does come into play. But we are dealing with the social determinants of health, not just the healthcare system. So that's the general structure. You have it early in advance of our publication on the 11th of February, and we will have recommendations within each of those six areas. Next slide, please. So as you get from that, we're very much taking a life course perspective. There's accumulation of positive and negative effects on health and well-being. So we go from prenatal, preschool, school, training, employment and retirement. Next, please. And so our recommendations relate to different points in the life course: early years, skills development, employment and work, prevention, and so on. And then sustainable communities and places and a healthy standard of living go right across the life course. But it's very much taking perspective that the right time to start is right at the very beginning, or even before then. Next. Context matters. Next slide. These next few I showed you at lunch yesterday, so I apologize, you see them again. What you've got here is the share of total household income that each fifth of the earnings distribution have. So you can see that the top fifth of earnings, over a 30-year period from 1977 to 2005-6, enjoyed an increased share of total household earnings. It increased dramatically from 1977 to 1989-90. That was Mrs. Thatcher's contribution to life in Britain. The share that the top fifth had stopped increasing, but didn't go down. so the Labour government had to run very hard to stay in place to stop it increasing further, but it didn't go down. And you see the bottom fifth did go down. Now, the dotted line, so the blue line is gross income pre-tax. The dotted line is post-tax. You probably thought, I thought, that we had a progressive taxation system. I thought that the purpose of the taxation system at some level, was apart from raising money for the government, was to redistribute income. I thought, silly me, that rich people paid a higher proportion of their income in taxation than poor people. How silly I was. How naive. And look at Labour. Did it make any bloody difference at all? Absolutely not. The problem was we had a big shift from direct taxation, which is progressive, income tax is progressive, to indirect taxation, consumption tax, which is regressive. As I said to our colleagues, they're not here, as I said to our colleagues at dinner last night from the health promotion, Thai health promotion, you've got the same situation that we have. Your poor people pay tax on tobacco and alcohol, which supports the Thai Health Promotion Foundation. They should be very grateful to the poor people of Thailand, because without the poor people of Thailand paying all those taxes, the Health Promotion Foundation would have no money. It's steeply regressive, and we've got the same situation. Next slide, please. So if we look at share of total equivalized disposable income, that's post-tax, by decile group between 1977 and 2006, you can see 1977, look at the bottom decile, their share went down. For the top decile, their share went up. So that's the context. It's all very well for us to say, put more money into early child development. But as our task group on early child development said, and we assembled 9 task groups to advise us, and our task group, and the reports of those task groups are available on the web. I'll show you the website at the end, and you can read those task groups. And our task group on early child development said, if you want to deal with inequalities in early child development, you have to deal with inequalities in society. Very clear. So that's the context. Now, I'm sure when my review was set up, when I was asked to conduct this review, the government did not want me to propose a change in taxation policy. And it's way beyond my competence to design a taxation policy. But I think it's quite wrong to have a fiscal policy that doesn't have redistribution at its heart. How wrong could you possibly be? Next slide, please. And it's important that we're working across government. We've been engaging with all of these government departments. And I think with, so far, I would say, a high degree of enthusiasm from the civil servants. I've been to talk to several of the cabinet ministers. And unusually for me, I've been to talk to several of the opposition shadow ministers. Who are, they would like to think, a government in waiting. And I put the argument, which is a bit rude, I suppose, but I try and be polite, that I think what we're doing is too important for party politics, is my argument, which I say is a bit rude to politicians who think what they do is the most important thing in life. And I say what I do is much more important than what you're doing. It's too important for party politics. And I'm not sufficiently well attuned with the way politicians think and behave and speak to know whether they're simply being polite or they're engaging with me. They appear to be engaging, but I say I'm not clever enough to know if it's real. but they seem to be interested. So I would hope we will have an election. It has to be by June next year. I would hope whoever forms the new government, my hope would be, would engage with this issue. Next. And this is part of the strategy. With the Commission on Social Determinants of Health, we had partner countries. What I've been trying to do in England is to get partner regions. This untidy-looking gentleman with the hair the way it is the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson. I think most of us are vain enough that when the photographers come, we tend to sort of do this, and he obviously does that when the photographers come. He's a larger-than-life character, and he's a conservative. So I went to talk to this conservative Mayor of London and said, would you be a partner of the review that we're doing? And to my amazement, he said yes. And they produced the London Health Inequalities Strategy, a draft for public consultation. Now, he's a conservative. Next slide, please. And these are the five strategic objectives. Empower individual Londoners and their communities to improve health and well-being. Next. Improve access to London's health and social care services, particularly for Londoners who have poorer health outcomes. Now, are you ready for the third one? You ready for this? Ready? Reduce income inequalities and minimize the negative health consequences of relative poverty. In their inequality strategy, they have a graph of the gradient. I thought, my God, a Tory, a conservative leading politician has got the gradient in there and the implications that you can't focus only on the very poorest. I mean, as I read this, I said to Rudiger yesterday, I was reading their inequality strategy and I thought, I could have written this. And then I read some more of it and thought, I did write this. They've taken it from the commission report, they've taken it from the draft, our interim reports of the review. It's great. It's fantastic. We've got a leading conservative politician to reproduce what we've been saying. It's absolutely great. Mm. Number four, increase opportunities for people to access the potential benefits of work and other forms of meaningful activity. Five, next. London is a healthy place for all. When I did go to see him, I did cycle to City Hall, and he is an enthusiastic cyclist, the mayor. So we had something in common, but I had to get him off cycling. He thought the route to good health for all Londoners was for everybody to cycle. But, I think that would be a good thing. Now, so we've got a prominent Conservative signed up. Next, I went to the Northwest as well, Liverpool and Manchester. You'll be pleased to know Manchester United is not a Thai football club. It's an English football club, and it's in the northwest. And that's a Labour area. It's Labour controlled. So we've got a Labour region and a Conservative region, both signed up with this, and they're ready to go. In fact, they're going already. So one of the things that I hope is when we report on the review, we will have enthusiastic buy-in from the Northwest, from London, and there's a number of cities. I'm getting daily requests from Coventry and Sheffield and all over the place that they're really interested in the review and what they can do. They want to make this real. Next. So as I say, we will publish it on the 11th of February, and that's the website. You can download from the website the reports of the task groups, and we produced an interim report for the government, and the final report will also be on the website.
Thank you very much for your inspiring information, and we are looking forward to reading that report, and it's I think it will be more tangible action on what England's going to move forward. And next, I would like to invite Honourable Mary Collins for the draw experience from Canada and especially British Columbia, please.
Thank you very much. And first of all, just while I'm getting the presentation up, there, can you get that to the? I would like to thank our Thai hosts for inviting me. This has been a very exciting few days, and I'm deeply impressed with the work that your National Health Assembly is doing, and we'll be taking back a lot of lessons and all the excitement involved. And so it's a great experience. Now, what I'd like to share with you is a little bit of the work that's been going on in Canada regarding social determinants of health. I'll start by saying that this is not new. In fact, it's... In fact, it was 35 years ago that the first report at a national level was published by the then Minister of Health, Mr. Lalonde, where they talked about health being determined by more than health services, and much of the language that we talk about now, that health is not just the absence of disease, really was founded in that report 35 years ago. And then, as some others have mentioned, in 1986, the Ottawa Charter and the EPP report talked about reducing health inequities as a top priority for health. So it's not that this is new, it's just taking a long time to really get action on it. 1994, our Canadian Institute for Advanced Research talked about why some people are healthy and others are not. That was another one. And the same year, the whole population health approach, which we now take for granted, but it was new at that point, was adopted by federal and provincial ministers. Just a few years ago, in 2003, a task group on health disparities was formed. And then the Public Health Agency of Canada was launched as a separate agency with responsibility for both non-communicable and communicable disease, but has taken a special interest in social determinants of health. And our Chief Public Health Officer, Dr. David Butler-Jones, published this report in 2008, which basically sets out the current state of the situation in Canada and makes a whole range of recommendations regarding social determinants of health and health inequities. And just earlier this year, the Senate Committee, which is the upper house in our Parliament, published a report on health inequities under the leadership of Senator Keon. So there's been a lot of work at the national level. And some of the other activities nationally have involved the development of an integrated healthy living chronic disease strategy, which includes as part of the objectives to reduce health disparities. Establishment of a national collaborating center, and this was following Sir Michael Marmot's report on social determinants of health. And that has also been very active in working with groups across the country to provide the knowledge node, synthesizing knowledge, helping to share that with groups across the country, translation and helping all the other groups who are interested have that kind of common knowledge base. And there's also been some what we would call intersectoral actions at the level of the federal government, the whole child development policy and a homelessness initiative, which took into consideration the implications of these policy on the future health and certainly have been stepped forward. But of course, really many or most of the factors that influence ultimately our health status and health inequities really fall within the responsibility of our provinces, because health, education, social welfare are all provincial responsibilities. So many provinces have undertaken work. Usually the public health sector has been the leader and the champion, and that's good, although it does carry with us some problems, because I find that often the other sectors then just say, well, this is a health issue, and what we're trying to get across is this is not just a health issue, this is an issue for everybody, transportation, social services, education, the joined up effect, and it's sometimes hard. They'll start to talk about it, but then they'll sort of say, oh yeah, but you guys in health, you're the ones that really have to do the work. But in British Columbia, And I hope you all know where British Columbia is. How many have been to British Columbia? I know Nunut has, if you have. It's our most western province, right on the Pacific Ocean. 4.4 million residents, but very long and narrow, and with a concentration of population in the south, which borders the U.S., and then many small communities throughout the north, and quite a large and extensive Aboriginal First Nations population as well, which holds its own challenges. And so within British Columbia, the BC Healthy Living Alliance, which I've been involved in for the last couple of years, we were an NGO which brought together players from right across a whole variety of sectors. And our original mission was to improve the health of all British Columbians through leadership and collaboration to reduce the risk factors that contribute significantly to chronic disease. But as the Alliance started to do its work, and we have programs running throughout the province around healthy eating and physical activity, tobacco reduction, community capacity building, we realized that we weren't going to achieve the targets that we had set for ourselves because of the fact that some folks are not going to eat healthy food because they don't have the money to buy it. Some people are not going to be physically active because they live in neighborhoods where there's no access, or they don't have the money, they don't have the time to be physically active. And in smoking, although British Columbia has the lowest rate of smoking in the country, about 14%, those who are smoking are in the lower socioeconomic groups, and it is much harder to persuade them to give up smoking because of all of the other stresses often that they are under. So just earlier this year, in fact, the Alliance added the words "and health inequities that contribute significantly to chronic disease." So that has become very much part of our mission. And as I mentioned, we're an alliance of organizations that represent the chronic disease groups, heart and stroke, cancer, lung, and huge numbers of volunteers throughout the province, but also organizations such as the Union of BC Municipalities, which represents all of the communities throughout BC and the municipal leaders, and the BC Recreation and Parks, which represents all of the people involved in recreation. So it's a very diverse alliance, and sometimes that makes it challenging to get cohesion around our policies, but it does have a lot of influence. And our health, all of our health authorities and our provincial health ministry of healthy living are represented on our policy groups as well, so we have direct linkages into decision making at many different levels. And why, people might say, in Canada, well, Canada, you've got universal health care and you're a healthy place, why are you concerned about these? But in Canada, it's still evident that, for example, rates of heart disease and diabetes are 50% higher in groups with low socioeconomic status. And those diseases, as you've seen from all the other statistics, are growing. Diabetes is becoming just rampant. It's a huge problem. And it's estimated that socioeconomic inequities in health are responsible for more than 20% of health costs. And we are really concerned. Our health costs are growing much faster than the rate of inflation, much faster than any other area of government. In British Columbia, they are now consuming 45% of the total provincial budget. And the trajectory, if nothing changes, means that they would consume over 70%, maybe 80%. So there'd be nothing left, you know, and that's just unsustainable. So that's what's really got the attention of politicians and leaders from the business and other sectors as well, that, you know, and yes, okay, get people to live healthy, but it's more than that. Whoops. Sorry, what have I done here? I should let you do this. So we started a process to look at the social determinants of health inequities in British Columbia. We commissioned a study to begin with. We did public polling. We found out that the majority of British Columbians actually supported the kinds of actions that we were suggesting. And that was very powerful in going to the politicians because they were very nervous about some of these ideas. And we, like yourselves, we had a big policy discussion, the first one in Vancouver. We had a draft paper, and what were identified as the high priority items were the establishment of a health equity plan with targets and timelines, because we don't think governments can be effective if they don't have that sort of force behind them. And we set out what we suggested were appropriate targets. a poverty reduction strategy also with timelines and targets, and a big focus on early childhood development and child care. We really see that as being absolutely critical, and affordable housing became the other major priority. But then we took the show on the road, and we went across the province, and we consulted with representatives of 202 organizations in workshops around the province. We brought people in by video conference, very small communities, government leaders, business leaders, community leaders, Aboriginal leaders, had the same kinds of discussions with them to make sure that what we were suggesting was reflective of the realities of people who were living in much more remote parts of the province. And what was interesting is that what we heard there were a lot of issues around food security, you'd think, you know, BC, food security, but that's a big problem. If you live in a remote community, to get fresh produce is very expensive and often not accessible. Transportation, a big issue, again, to be able to get transportation, to be able to be involved in healthy activities, to be able to get to work, to be able to get to health services, and certainly the needs of our Aboriginal people, which where the statistics are still pretty grim in terms of their outlook. So we published our report, what's called Healthy Futures for BC Families, in September of this year. And it's been widely disseminated across the province and actually throughout the country. And there's 45 recommendations for action to address health inequities in British Columbia. And they focus on in education, early childhood development and child care, food security, livable communities, income security, those whole range of social determinants of health. And there have been some actions. The government just about a month ago agreed to support an initiative to provide produce to rural and remote communities, working with business, transportation, agriculture, and a number of community groups to see, you know, actually implement something that we had been recommending. So we were very pleased with that. But there's a lot more to be done. As Michael had mentioned, there are still big discrepancies in life expectancy. In our largest city of Vancouver, from the neighborhood that was the highest life expectancy, there's a 10-year difference, even within the city, between the highest and the lowest. So there's a lot of work to be done. So what do we see as the next steps? Well, developing alliances with other organizations with similar agendas, and there's many of those. Attempting to involve more business leaders, and that's a challenge because business has a hard time seeing it as part of their agenda. And what we look for are some champions, and I've been fortunate. I'm chairing a task force for the Vancouver Board of Trade on, interestingly enough, it's been named Health, Wellness, and Well-Being. And even the fact they've used that language has been really interesting to accept those concepts. And, of course, we're out meeting and making presentations to many groups. Some of the challenges, the difficult economic times that we've all been through have resulted in constraints in government spending. And many of the groups that often relied on government grants have been reduced. And that's, you know, and there's very little money for new programs. We meet with our ministers and they say, bring us suggestions that don't cost a lot of money. We'll think about regulatory reforms, maybe taxation reforms, but we just don't have any money for the next couple of years, so we're working around that. There's also the stereotypes of poverty, and we run into this, I don't know if you do, but there's a lot of views still held that if you give people money, they're going to spend it on beer and popcorn, so that, you know, there's a resistance. And as soon as you start talking about poverty reduction, you also get this resistance. So we're trying to come up with different kinds of language to talk about these issues. And, of course, the fear of the costs involved and who would have to pay more. I mean, it's your redistribution is not an easy thing to do, and those who have don't necessarily want to give up. We're all willing to go out and cook Christmas dinner for the poor, but we're not necessarily willing to give up our own amenities. So the case for government that we see is that we're not going to make progress in improving the health of all of our citizens without addressing the underlying social conditions and health inequities, and that healthcare costs, particularly chronic disease, are continuing to escalate and they're going to become unaffordable. And this is what's scaring politicians. So our Minister of Health, we met with him about a week ago, and he gets it. He does understand it. It's just a question of, you know, how are we going to get moving on this, I think. The case for business, investment in policies that raise social conditions also result in a better educated and productive workforce, and there's been some good work done by that by the Business Council of BC. And they show that if we don't do some of these things, it will result in $2 billion of lost productivity. So we do have some good economic arguments we can make. And also the reduction in crime, that really resonates, we find, with the business community and building safer and healthier communities. And as Michael was talking about in England, we are trying to work with communities and get them to develop action plans as well. And finally, the case for the public comes back often to values. We think it's really important to talk about values and fairness. Can we call it social justice? We view sort of fairness, ensuring that all citizens have an opportunity to enjoy healthy lives. Compassion, that is something that is inherent in most people. You can appeal to that. The social cohesion, we really think that's important, because if you look at societies where there is huge differences in the socioeconomic gradient, there are often those that are unstable, and we've always prided ourselves as being pretty socially cohesive, although we have many vulnerable groups as well. And then finally, a lot of people, you appeal to them because they believe in people taking responsibility for themselves. That's the argument. And so we say, well, if we can provide citizens with the tools, with the income, with the knowledge, with the capacity by increasing their social economic conditions, they are going to be much more able to make responsible decisions about their own health. Without that, it becomes extremely difficult. So the future, we need more public awareness and support. We need whole of government approaches. In British Columbia, they created a Act Now BC, which is a cross-governmental agency which deals with, it's been very good, and all departments are required in their business plans to include the implications for health of their policies. What we want them to do is to broaden that and to look at it through the lens of health inequity, not just health, and so we've been working on that. But there is the beginning. So the Ministry of Transport, they have now that all new transportation projects have to include provisions for walking and biking facilities and greenways. Balanced both targeted and universal approaches, because I don't think it can be completely one or another in a realistic cross-sectoral involvement, and that's really important to get all sectors working together. And a focus on community, because so much of the action is at the community level, and developing and supporting community leaders. They know what's needed in their communities, and we feel a bottom-up approach can be so much more dynamic than just waiting for the top-down. And, of course, developing indicators, because we have to know, we have to be able to measure, we have to monitor, and we have to be accountable. And finally, integrating health equity considerations into all of our policies and programs. So if you would like more information about the work we've been doing, all our reports and lots of background information, that's our website. And we're also very active on Twitter. We have thousands of followers now, which is lots of fun. And I'll be glad to share these documents with you. Thanks.
Thank you, too. We have heard best practices from two countries already. Actually, there are many civil societies in many countries that drive the SDH movement as well. But we can't invite all here, right? So we invite only Global Coordinator of People Health Movement instead to share the view. Please, Ms. Bridget Loy.
Hi, I've been saying continuously, I think, through the last few days, that there's so much that we're actually learning from Thailand, where, for me, one of the things that we see here is the relationship between government, civil society, and researchers, and many countries actually have a long way to go before they reach that. So some of the examples that I'm using here are going to be trying to link some of what we do globally, but obviously global only exists because of regional, because of national, and because of local. So I'll be linking all of that. I was asked to look at how social determinants of health has been initiated in the people's health movement. How do we keep the social determinants of health running, and in what scope, and what are the challenges? So I think for us, and Thailand's also spoken about that in their presentation, is that in 1978, the Alma Ata Conference, which called for health for all by the year 2000, and all of the principles that were brought out and carried forward from the Alma Ata were actually linked with the social determinants of health. It unfortunately got forgotten really quickly, but some of the highlights for us were the Alma Ata Declaration defined health as an outcome of interaction amongst social and economic factors and as a fundamental human right. It adopted comprehensive primary health care as an essential tool to achieve health for all and called for multi-sectoral and multidisciplinary action. So that was before the People's Health Movement started. And what happened was that a number of health activists and organizations, civil society movements, started saying, we're not getting health for all. So 2000 in Bangladesh, we had a first People's Health Assembly and the People's Health Movement was born. We had people from 92 different countries and almost 1,500 participants there. That was preceded by preparatory action around the globe, and that went down to village meetings. So it was really represented. And what came out of that was the People's Charter for Health, and I've brought a few copies along, which I'm going to leave with Nanut. In the People's Charter for Health, a few key things that are there is health is a social, economic, and political issue, and above all, a fundamental human right. Inequality, poverty, exploitation, violence, and injustice are at the root of ill health and the death of poor and marginalized people. Health for all means that powerful interests have to be challenged, that globalization has to be opposed, and that political and economic priorities have to be drastically changed. I'm not going to go through all of those. It is available on our website. So if anyone wants to look more, then it's some of the background information that went into the charter. So how do we, that was the entry point for us. I mean, it's how PHM, it's the foundation of what's built PHM is basically on the social determinants of health. So what do we do within PHM to keep it alive? We really do look at global, regional, national, and local levels. PHM was involved in the commission through civil society voices, as well as one of our co-chairs was on the commission, Fran Baum. We look at education and information, and alternative analysis and watching, and mobilization and campaigning, and I'm going to go a bit more into detail into all of those. This was in November, one of our International People's Health University that was held in Cuba. Now, the International People's Health University is one of our tools. It's basically a roving faculty where we get some of our top academic people who are involved with people's health movement, and at the request of a country and a region, we bring those people to the country, and we basically have learning, sharing, and planning opportunities for activists and researchers in developing countries, primarily in developing countries. It provides a networking amongst health activists and young researchers all over the globe, contributes to renewing the people's leadership, and we touch on issues from globalization, social determinants of health, comprehensive primary health care, trade and health, etc. We take all of those and we try and demystify them so that people understand the impact of trade on health, the social determinants of health and their link. One of our other tools is Global Health Watch. Now, we've produced two editions so far. The first edition and the second edition, we get a lot of anecdotal stories about how they've been used. Now, Global Health Watch 1, I know in South Africa in Parliament, one of the shadow ministers of transport used the chapter on climate change to try and lobby for changes within the transport system in South Africa. We have, our public transport system is really poor. We rely a lot on what we call minibus taxis, which are often unsafe and are, it's a cause of death on the roads. So Global Health Watch, the second edition, it's had more than 160 people involved in writing, and it's 80 NGOs in producing the report. We see the production of the report as part of a mobilization process in itself. It provides an alternative analysis, but the process of developing it creates networks amongst people, There's a lot of collaboration that takes part, and we introduce new we'll have north-south collaborations, etc. We look at the current paradigm around globalization, health systems, and the larger sections are actually on the health determinants and watching. We also used examples of social movements and resistance. I'm not going to go through all of those chapters, but if you look at Beyond Healthcare, where we look at carbon trading and climate change, terror war and health, food, urbanization, etc., those all looked way beyond the health sector, but tried to actually provide information linking issues that aren't classically seen as the health sector to the health sector. Similarly, within the watching section, there are areas which cover an analysis and a watching. Some of it is of the funders and how funders themselves often, and government aid often actually forces funding into a disease-based program. It's much easier to measure the outcomes of treatment than it is to measure the outcomes of something that's way broader than treatment. The next example I want to use of the People's Health Movement is the Right to Health campaign. What we do is we've been linking and mapping at local, national, and global levels. Now, the global has provided a framework which gets adapted to the national level. So what we do is assess the status of right to health in each country, but we'd use the legal framework that exists within the country. There's national networking in action, and at the moment it's in India, Palestine, Egypt, South Africa, Mali, Gabon, Congo-Kinshasa, Congo-Brazzaville, Guatemala, Uruguay, and we've got a growing number of right-to-health circles. The India was one of the first ones, and that what they had was what they called people's health tribunals. They went into some of the most remote areas, and people came and told their stories. In South Africa, the India one was quite focused on healthcare. In South Africa, we launched it and we invited India to come over and to inspire us, but what we did was organize a huge march and mobilization of people in the community, and we've made it very clear that we're not focusing on health, we're focusing on the broader determinants of health. So some of the placards aren't clear there. I'm hoping they are. If you see, they're decent and affordable housing as our right. Without this, we will not achieve good health. There was ones on water, ones on sanitation. What we did was plant the pickets around the communities. We walked through some of our slum areas in Cape Town, and where we found a particularly bad situation, we would plant one of the placards and actually dig it into the ground. Now, South Africa's got a really good constitution, so what's happening is we're using the constitution to try and get the government to actually look quite broadly at the conditions people are living in and how these deny their right to health. We're getting communities to come forward and tell their stories, and we're going to use these combined with, to present to the Human Rights Commission, as well as some of the constitutional and legal frameworks within the country. We've got the Human Rights Commission on board. Unfortunately, we don't have the same relationship with civil society as Thailand's got, so we're having to present it to the government in a way that they cannot ignore. Then generally, PHM is involved in, this isn't the Right to Health campaign, but it's actually trying to get communities mobilized around various different issues. We lobby various international organizations as well as initiatives, and I think some of this is at a individual basis, that we will be at a conference where something is being presented and we are continuously trying to actually raise awareness of the social determinants of health and the impact of some of these broader social determinants on health. But then we also have issue circles. So WHO, we always have a pre-WHA civil society workshop. There's research that we do. We put forward position papers. And we're looking at the moment, at human resources for health as a separate issue group because it's such a crisis that's going on globally. Recently, one of the ones that we put forward a position statement on was the World Health Summit that was organized in Germany, which was primarily funded by pharmaceutical companies and quite sort of disease-based. A number of our people got invited, but we decided not to go and rather put forward some concerns about it. challenges. I think one, getting proper buy-in from the health sector actors, as well as beyond the health sector, that there's often a lack of understanding of the social determinants of health, and we try and look at how to link policy and make policy more understandable by civil society so they can use that policy to inform their action as well as to feed into policy. Disease and treatments are much easier to measure, so you tend to find that the finances follow the diseases within the health sector. An example was in South Africa, we had community health workers who were very much development workers and used to work on issues of trying to make sure there was good sanitation, lobby for safer pension pay points in the area. And those basically have been reduced by government, and we've got single issue workers at the moment which focus more on diseases. We intersectoral support and collaboration, very often you will find that the other sectors say health, that's not our problem. And walking here this morning, I'm very direction challenged and I thought I was getting lost. So I asked somebody, where's the convention center? It happened to be the somebody attending the Asian transport meeting that's happening in the same building. And so I started asking him, what are you discussing at your forum? And he said, transport. So I said, so are you looking at transport and the impact on climate change and transport and the impact on health? And he said, no, we look at transport. So that's it. And that's happening in the same building as this. Then financial and treasury support. It's, again, how do you get that collaboration? And I think that's at the global as well as national and local levels. And I think one of the ones recently, I sort of had a meeting in Belgium looking at a global health fund, which is trying, there's been moves to try and look at a fund which looks beyond the diseases. And I asked someone from the World Bank there whether they had taken note of the Commission's report last year and whether there was any influence on their policy and their financing. They did respond that Michael Marmot had been invited to speak to them in Washington, but he didn't answer regarding the policy and the financial changes. It hit me at the beginning of the session when you're doing the presentation on the network here in Thailand, the political will. If the political will isn't there, it's really difficult. And I think that to me is, if there isn't a political will to work with civil society and researchers and the other sectors, it becomes something where there's often a tension between those different sectors, and rather than working together, you find out you've actually got to find alternative ways to work. So I think that's what PHM tries to do, is to try and say, how can you actually force it that at the global and national levels, there's more looking at these issues? I think that's just really that some of the tools that we actually work with, we've had two People's Health Assemblies, and the third one is going to be in 2011 in Cape Town in South Africa. And I think it would be really interesting if there was mobilization in Thailand and some collecting of stories and how progress on your social determinants of health network progresses and moves forward, and if you could bring that to the People's Health Assembly, because it's something we can all learn from these stories. We can all, you know, the strengths of one country are sometimes the weakness of the others. We can learn from that, and I think it would be really wonderful if you did. And I think that's our website of both the People's Health Movement and the Global Health Watch. We've got a lot of literature on the Global Health Watch that is downloadable, including the full editions of Global Health Watch. And we try and change some of our literature into things that are more easily usable by civil society, by researchers, by academics. So we put documents out like Global Health Action, which takes a few actions out of the Global Health Watch for people who are lazy to read the whole edition, and actually says this is how you can move forward with it. And all of those are downloadable. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Bridget. And I have to sorry everyone to keep you listen only. And probably you have many questions pop up and want to discuss. Any questions by now? Right. Yes, please. Can you introduce yourself as well?
Thank you. Maureen Birmingham from WHO here in Thailand. Just a question on the People's Health Movement looking at what's happening here in Thailand with it actually involving the government as one piece of part of the triangle. Does the People's Health Movement involve, try to bring along with them the government, or are they really kept at a distance or separate? Thanks.
No, we think it's ideal if government can be brought along. Unfortunately, not all governments are as willing to. So, I mean, that to me, where Thailand's a really positive example, where the government is willing to work with civil society, in fact, is even providing significant funding to things like the National Health Commission and providing syntaxes towards the Health Promotion Foundation. It's not happening in many other countries that you're seeing that openness and the willingness to work with civil society. So we are really willing to work with governments, but they're not always willing to work with us.
Just to add a little bit, we are not lucky to have this kind of mechanism. We say that we have lost a lot of sweat, but not life, to get this mechanism. And I think a lot of people in this loop can share this experience in order to how the Thailand have this kind of mechanism. But it's not easy, and it's not occur by luck.
Yes, please.
Yes, thank you all four. I think it was very nice to see the sequence of interventions here. Bridget, you just told us about your meeting with the person from the transport sector. I actually think we have to make an effort to meet their agendas and not wait until they come to us. And the question I have related to that to actually all four of you is, what sort of recommendations would you give on the how-to? How will we be influential in meeting other people's agendas in the different, you know, roles that you have, civil society, government, academia?
Well, this has certainly come up in our discussions with other government departments. They get really nervous if they think we're proposing a separate agenda. Mm. What? You're now going to have health as a separate agenda. And I'm at some pains to point out, no, it's not separate. Health inequalities, which is the language we use, results from not doing your job properly in education, not doing your job properly in finance, not doing your job properly in transport. So this is not a separate agenda. This is a social accountancy mechanism. This is a way of your finding out if you're doing your job properly, and that wouldn't you want to be doing your job properly, so that we need a collective agenda across government where health inequalities, and we proposing that we measure outputs and outcomes so that you've got some idea what's happening sooner than waiting for the outcomes, so you measure outputs, mm-hmm. so that they can see in these different government departments that I listed whether they're doing their job well. And that tends to reassure people a bit, that we're not proposing, that they're not doing everything for health. So the Minister of Transport has not become a health minister, much as I would like him to become a health minister. But he does at least recognize that what he does will have impact on health, and that ought to be one of the criteria by which he assesses whether he is doing his job properly.
Perhaps I could just add, the ACT-NOW-BC model, which I mentioned, which is the intersectoral model within government, actually WHO has just recently released a report, and they reviewed that, and it was they commended it, basically. There's some flaws. But it has made a big difference. There's every 3 weeks, the assistant deputy ministers of each of the departments meet and discuss their priorities and what's going on, and we had an opportunity of meeting with them recently to talk about social determinants of health and health inequities, and we found there was a lot of understanding. But one of the important things is the leadership has to come from the top. And this was the premier, who's like our prime minister of the province. It was his it was his decision that we wanted to do this. And we've been a little concerned that that might not continue post-Olympics, as this was kind of all a build-up to British Columbia being the healthiest jurisdiction to host the Olympics. But we just met with, had some meetings last week again on this, and they said, no, the premier is committed to this. It is going to continue. We're looking at the mandate. We want your input on what that mandate will be. So we feel quite encouraged about that. When you start getting outside of government and looking at, you know, the transport sector and the agricultural sector, it is more challenging. In our consultations around the province, we tried to include people from all of those sectors. Some came, some didn't. It's a question of kind of reaching out to them, not being threatening, you know, saying you've got a role to play. So much is personal relationships, too, are really important, and having credibility. So it's a long, slow process. It's not one magic answer. You've got to keep working at it.
For Thailand, we think that it's not easy to jigsaw, say that each social determinant of health that comprise of the various organization or sector get involved. So we need like a template to jigsaw that, okay, this determinants comprise of this and that, and you pay this part and that part. But by our experience, it's quite difficult to integrate this at the central level or even the provincial level. So at this moment, we consider that the most interesting place to integrate this at the community, at the local administration, because the scale is small and all the stakeholders are in that place, and the people and the community is in an integrated manner. So, and at this moment, for Thai system, the local authority, the local administration, they have a responsible area. They have legal right to move, and the most important, they have money. So this kind of thing, like a national assembly, if they join the people, the committee in their responsible area, and the technical side from the NGO or from the government side, together is a small triangle at the local level. And from this, they can move better than policy from the top. But the best is to match the upstream and the downstream. But if we have to choose, select the bottom one.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that one of the things that we've seen in South Africa is there's been a lot of mobilization lately because of lack of service delivery. And the lack of service delivery is lack of access to clean water, refuse removal not being done, etc. And it's turning into protests. It's got government listening. But then what we've been doing is then trying to link that, to make the link to the awareness of health. And I think every context is slightly different, and you've got to look at those opportunities all over. And when we were asked this question now, I thought we've actually recently been asked by the government of Guatemala to come and run the International People's Health University to assist them in reforming their health system. And I was thinking, well, actually, what could be a good forum is to have, not through the whole 2 weeks that the forum is taking place, but possibly invite or suggest that they invite some of their ministers or senior people from the other sectors to certain days within the International People's Health University, where we can start drawing those links. So I agree. I think if you can link the two, you can link the local, you can link the national, and then also linking it with what's happening globally. You know, the use the commission's report so that can actually be used to, you know, assist further what's happening at the national levels. It's so much effort and resources got into producing that report, and there's a lot of workable material in there. And if we can all get our national governments or mayors of cities or whatever to start quoting from the report and drawing those links, I think there'll be huge progress.
I was just going to add before, when Bridget said she asked somebody from the World Bank if they had a policy on social determinants of health, and the answer is they do. Their policy was to invite me to Washington.
Maybe I would like to share a bit more from Thailand. I am Supakit Nanthawarakan, a researcher from Healthy Public Policy Foundation. I think that to share with the board question first, working with the government, I think the first keyword for us is the evidence. How can we as the civil society or academics can join together and produce the very good evidence until the government, the transport department or the energy department cannot deny it. Yes, that's the entry point for us. But we try to make the evidence to create the common agenda. Maybe it's very hard to talk under the language of the Department of Trade or Department of Transport. But we try to use the evidence strong enough to invite them, let's call it invite them to the common agenda. For example, health, we invite them to a national health assembly that many parts of Thai society come with to this forum for the common agenda. But we do not use the authority approach. We try to use more as the deliberative approach, that you from the transport, from the government, from the business can deliberate in the process. That is not we will force you to do something. Of course, we cannot do that. But we try to use the evidence to invite them to the common agenda in the deliberative manner. And with that, we hope to continue this, what we call public policy process, that try to link bottom and the top together. We do not totally, completely success yet, but we're still trying.
Any questions? Because right now, yes, please.
My name is Dr. Phong Pisut from the Health System Research Institute. I think the social determinant of health is quite a new initiative. I don't know who led this kind of movement, maybe the WHO and also some people here in this room also. But what have already been presented in the presentation since Thai movement and also Sir Michael Mamor said also, this is part of the evolution of the global policy and global movement in order to solve the problem of the people in the world, we can say it like that. We can see that, okay, what has been presented in the Amalta Declaration, that the Health for All policy, we have some similarity when compared with the issue of social determinant of health and the Health for All policy. My question is that, is there any new strategy or new way of thought that arises because of when we introduce the new concept of social determinant of health? Because when we are talking about bringing all people to work together, it's related to the previous recommendation of the WHO of intersectoral collaboration or something like that. Or even we are working with something that we would like to empower the people, is also linked to the previous recommendation of the WHO that, okay, we have to empower community. This is part of the previous recommendation. My question is there any new recommendation according to the social determinant of health that you would suggest the people to do in order to achieve the goal? Thank you.
Well, if I may, it's a good question, and I've certainly been asked this many times since we published the report, and a bureaucrat from the European Commission asked me pretty much the same, didn't we know this? And my response was, first, it was in Almerata, and what did we do globally? We ignored it, completely ignored it, went galloping off in the opposite direction. Not only did we not take action globally on social determinants of health, we pursued a different agenda globally. The Washington Consensus on liberalization and privatization. The public sector was supposed to be evil. Everything in the private sector was good. comprehensive primary health care, forget it. That didn't get... So we didn't do any of it. So it's not that... Even were it the case that there was nothing new, it would be worth saying again, because we didn't do it in 1978. So, I mean, you know, live together, love, I mean, that goes back in Buddhist traditions forever. When the commission went to Iran, Mr. Rafsanjani said, 1400 years ago, the prophet came and taught that there are two fundamental human needs, health and psychological security, and they're linked. Well, that, I thought, gosh, I do research at University College London on how what happens in the mind is linked to health. I mean, and it's, I'm being told that Muhammad knew this 1400 years ago. So whether it's Buddhism or Christianity or Judaism or Islam, we knew all this. But that doesn't mean each generation doesn't have to discover it for itself. The second is that since between 1978 and now, there's been an enormous amount of research. We actually know a lot more. We actually know a lot more. So that, firstly, it would have been worth restating, even had there been nothing new. Secondly, there's an enormous amount of research that's gone on in the 30 years. And I mean research as I learnt once I started chairing the commission, in the broader sense, what the civil society brought to us and country experience, not just research that people like me do in a university. So there's been an enormous amount of evidence that's come in the 30 years. And thirdly, what the commission did was actually take, if you like, general principles that were in Almarata and say, right, this is what you need to do on early child development. This is what you need to do on education. This is what you need to do on fair financing. This is what you need to do on market responsibility. This is what you need to do on gender equity. This is what you need to do on employment. None of which was in Almarata. So, yeah, I would hope that we were, if you like, rediscovering some fundamental truths that are central to the world's great religions and the tradition of scientific humanism. But we were trying to take that understanding and say what you could do with it in order to achieve health equity. So I think, yeah, it's worth rediscovering it, and it's going to need to be rediscovered again and again. But we have to restate it. And it's a way of galvanizing action. And you can see, I mean, it's just wonderful to hear from Thailand, from British Columbia, from South Africa, and globally what's happened as a result. So that, in a way, says it was worth doing.
Thank you. I'm quite agree with Sir Mahmoud. I think Dr. Maureen may comment a little bit about this. Because for the WHO, they're quite concerned, especially for the Southeast Asian region. They already announced that they will revitalize primary health care concept addressing social determinant of health. So this, I think it's a very good thinking about how to move. For Thailand, as I mentioned earlier, that we have used the primary health care concept, and we have leveled up our infrastructure according to that, and it's still this still be the backbone of our health service delivery system of Thailand. And as I mentioned, we have the decentralization act, we have a lot of movement, but our movement focus at the downstream or at the local level. And if that's the local triangle work, there's no need for you to push them. You just support them. And to initiate how to think, what do you want or what do you need? And is the real need of your community under the sufficient economy concept of our king? And from that need, what do you can? Not start from ask for, request for, from the government or something. What do you can and what do you have? And after that, what will you do? That means that it should start from you, from that community. You want to do this, you want to achieve this, do you want to approach this or that, something like that. It should start from the people, not start from the government policy. And I think government already said that allocate the power, the authority, and the resource to the local. But how the technical side support the local authority to move what in their hand and support the community to join this kind of mechanism. So that this is what Thailand moving at this moment. Thank you. May Dr. Maureen may comment something about revitalizing primary healthcare in this region.
I'll be very quick because we're running over, but I think you've said most of it, but I think the whole concept of moving from maybe a service delivery approach to a development approach where the community gets involved in their own health, first in diagnosing their situation, and health being that concept of well-being, and then linking that up with the social determinants of health even at the community level, and linking that up with the primary health care and primary care level. So it is a conceptual thing, I think, happening now in the Southeast Asia region, linking up all these concepts into something that's concrete in terms of what can be done. But it really does start with the community. Thanks.
Perhaps I can add some in response to your question. I think we in WHO, you're right, we've said for many years that you need intersectoral action for health, that you need healthy public policies, or now health in all policies. Now the question becomes more urgent, and we could relate that to the environmental sector. They also have said for many years that we have a global warming and that we need to have some concrete action. Thus, I think Michael Marmot is right. Not much has happened. We analyzed actually in the Health for All policy document that the area of healthy public policy was that area the least recognized in the whole policy document. Now, the question becomes more urgent because the things are interconnected, and we very much now see, due to the research that Sir Michael is doing and others, that indeed the things are interconnected and that we need to urgently work on those. And that is why we are so happy to see, you know, that like in Thailand, you're actually establishing accountability mechanisms and you're following up in a very rational way. So I'm very happy that you're doing the things in the way you do it, and other countries can learn a lot from you. The question is that I've asked, you know, what can we in WHO do to better support other countries to go along that way and to really galvanize on the lessons learned globally, to really make the how-to, because I think we now know the what. We need to move on the how-to in a much more consistent, proactive way.
I think the term, my name is Niyada. My background is on the health issue, but I'm now taking care on the Social Research Institute of Chulalongkorn University. I think the term social determinant of health, somebody may say, oh, it's an old wine in a new bottle. But to me, I think it's normally the health term we see from the people from the health background. So it's somebody look outside and try to understand the society, the health of the society. But now I think it should be the reverse as well. The society themselves look at the health issues and what their experience that can affect the health. And when professor mentioned about the how, I think it's now the time as well. I just attend one conference they call it the conference on social quality. So the social quality, they try to use some tools to measure the quality of the society, the social. And in that term, health is within that quality, not health is a separate issues. So just only one part on that. And I think now we should merge together between the either inside out or outside in together, use the term of health, but with many angles together to be the multidisciplinary.
I think because we are running out of time, and I think some of us have to attend the meeting to follow up their agendas. So on behalf of National Health Commission Office, I would like to thank all of you, the speakers, Sir Michael Marmot, Dr. Narongsa, Honorable Mary and Miss Bridget, for your experience. And I think this discussion inspires us to drive Thai SDH movement strategically. Thank you very much.